Lizzie Simmons, Lizzie Claire Simmons, owner of 6 kilograms of M&Ms. Thanks for joining me. How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, all good. Thank you. Very well. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Cool. And appreciate you sitting down. I know you want to be walking around like a caged tiger. well done and all of that. Awesome to have you on. Do you want to kind of give people some insight into who you are, what you do, where you come from, what's going on?
Yeah, definitely. So I am an ex-Olympic swimmer. I spent about 12 years competing for British Swimming and Team GB. Been to 2 Olympic Games and got a number of medals from the World Championships, Commonwealth Games, European Championships as well. I retired from professionally competing in 2018 after the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games. And since then, I've been trying my hand at a number of different things, both in sport and outside of sport as well, but generally become a little bit fascinated with the kind of psychology of human performance and why we do the things that we do and how athletes seem to be able to sustain such an amazing career for such a long time. And I've become passionate about sharing the tips and tricks from sport to other industries.
Were you fascinated when you swam?
Not so much. No, no. I think when you're in that world, you kind of think that that's just the way that everybody is. You think that everybody's just immensely motivated and everybody has goal setting strategies and everybody has, this skill set that you see around you and this high performance attitude. And then actually when you retire from sport and you go and work with other people, you realize how much the people struggle with those kind of things. So it's really, really interesting. And actually, I struggled with it as well. I suddenly didn't have the same goals and didn't have the same motivation when I left sport behind. So it was a bit of it served the dual purpose of hopefully helping other people, but also going on a bit of a journey of self-discovery as well, and how I maintain some of those systems and habits from sport into my career post-sport.
Nice. Well, we'll definitely pick up later on some of those tips and some of the stuff around transition. I used to go swimming at the Billingham Forum. It was about 10 or 20 p a session. I'm a little bit older than you. It felt like it was about 3 a.m. every day. And we did similar stuff. And I'll be honest with you, it was really boring. So there's my experiences of swimming. I've got some things from swimming galas. I was then looking at your times online earlier and going, yeah, you were quite quick. tell me about it. So what's it like? So clearly I've worked and, most of my life I've been working in team sports where we're not in the water. Lots of your stuff is individual. Clearly you would have some relay type stuff as well. What is it like? What's the experience of your experiences of swim coaching? Tell me about, well, start off, tell me the best stuff.
I think it is a unique sport. I think because it's not a weight-bearing sport, young athletes or young swimmers do almost as much as the elite swimmers sometimes. So from the age of 13, I was doing 60K a week in the pool, which is obviously a lot of training. You just choked on your coffee. alarm was set.
Billingham was a 33 and a third metre pool. Or yards or whatever it is. So let me just, so 60K, so that's a lot of lengths. That is
2,500 lengths in a 25 meter pool.
Oh my God. And it also makes you good at maths.
You've got plenty of time to think about it.
Your 25 lengths table must be like up there with the best in the world. So sorry.
That'll be my mastermind topic.
Yeah. Non-weight bearing, up to 60K a week. At what age?
13 onwards for me. So it was pretty intense from a pretty early age. I very quickly learned how to prioritize training and education and, trying to have a social life as well and trying to figure out who I was and, going on the journey that all young people go on through their teenage years. So, it is an interesting sport. It is a bit different from other sports. You are isolated for some of the time. I think you feel very much part of a team because it's really tough a lot of the time. So those people around you in the lanes around you, they do become like your best mates, your closest mates, your family, really, because you're all going through these hellish winter training blocks together. And of course, as you start to transition from a junior athlete into the senior ranks, you essentially start, I guess, managing the team around you. So you have a coach, a strength and conditioning coach, a nutritionist, a psychologist, a physiotherapist, a soft tissue therapist, like any other sport, but you start managing those people and letting them know what you need from them. And in my opinion, the best kind of coach-athlete relationship comes when there isn't really a hierarchy within that. The athlete is very much in charge and responsible of the direction of their career, although the coach might write the sessions, although the coach might occasionally shout at them or try and motivate them or try and kind of, you know, get them up if they're in a bad place in training, that it is led by the athlete, and it is understood that the athlete's in control of that. So yeah, had lots of different experiences, as you can imagine, over the course of a really long career. Some coaches who I've really got on with and we've really got that balance right, and others who we haven't quite got it right. So yeah, lots to kind of reflect back on, I guess, going into the world of work, where I guess you have bosses and things like that in a similar kind of respect, but maybe a little bit different in that they're not probably shouting at you for 5 hours a day.
without naming names, or what percentage of either your training or generally do you think is kind of autonomy supported? So the athlete or the swimmer or the person is kind of in charge, you know, organizing some stuff and having a significant say in what happens.
So I'd say when I was a younger athlete, you don't need as much of that because you're not as skillful and you're not as knowledgeable and you don't have as much experience as the coach probably does. So through my younger years, probably 15 to early 20s, I didn't have much autonomy, but I was also kind of okay with that. You know, the coach said what we were doing and we kind of followed along with it, and he was definitely, you know, authority above the athletes. Then it kind of flipped around a little bit the other way and I felt like I lacked authority, I lacked autonomy for a few years in the kind of middle section of my career. And I struggled a bit with that because I didn't really have control over what I was doing in the pool each day. And obviously it's a huge investment on a day-to-day, week-by-week basis of both time, energy, you know, are you giving everything to this? And if you feel like you're not in control of that, or you don't have control over the direction in which your career is going, then that can be really, really frustrating and really, and really demotivating as well. And then actually, at the very end of my career, I worked with an Australian coach for a couple of years up in Edinburgh. And I feel like during those years, we probably got the balance just about perfect for me. I was a very experienced athlete by then. I knew myself, my body, my training, you know, better than anybody did. But he was also an incredibly experienced coach. And I think we really got the balance right. We were coming into training weeks and we would have a meeting and sit down every single week, look at the week ahead. And my ideas were valued just as much as his ideas were valued during that, you know, during that meeting, looking towards the training block, the daily sessions. And I really felt like in that environment, I could kind of say, hey, I think this isn't quite working, or I think we should do something in a slightly different way, or I've got an idea about this. And sometimes he'd say, no, that's an awful idea, let's not do that. And sometimes he'd say, yeah, that's really interesting, let's discuss it. And that was probably in terms of, you know, my mental health and where I would be the best balance.
What do you get to choose your coaches? So last year, when my son chose his options, he chose his teachers, not his subjects. How does that work in swimming?
You do get to, of course, you get to choose your coaches. There are, within the UK, there are some high performance centres. So if you want to be part of those high performance centres, which are heavily funded and supported by British Swimming, it's the kind of environment like you would have in lots of different sports where everything would be on site. You'd have the doctors over there, the physios would be there, you'd get everything that you needed right, you know, where you were training. If you want to be part of those centres, then there are, I guess you're limited to the coaches that operate there. If you want to go outside of that, then you have free rein in where you train. You might face other limits in terms of pool times and things like that. Whereas obviously in a training center, you probably have priority over the public lanes, things like that, when it comes to pool time and priority within the session. So there are some structures already in place. And if you want to be part of those, then you're limited in terms of coaches. If you want to go elsewhere, then you can.
You are the bane of my life. You're the person that has the lanes when I want to be playing volleyball in the pool.
And you're the annoying person that keeps knocking the ball into the lane when I'm trying to train.
So how was it? How did you make it enjoyable, or how did coaches make it enjoyable? Give me some examples, because 60k a week. How many weeks? How many weeks of the year?
So that'd probably be around 40 to 45 weeks of the year. Be doing that. And then there'd be another 5 or 6 weeks on top of that, which would be our taper weeks before competitions, where it'd be a bit less than that. And then, you'd have 3 weeks off, I guess, across the course of the year around, after competitions and things. So pretty full on. I worked out not so long ago that I'd swum on average 2.2 million meters every year for the last 15 years.
Yeah, I was trying to work out how many times you'd swam around the world.
Probably a couple.
How did they make stuff enjoyable, or how did the coaches, how did you, between you and other athletes? I mean, I'm thinking 60k a week in a pool on my own.
I can't think of anything worse.
I can't speak to anyone. The other people are like in the other lanes, and we're going to do the same next week. And the week after, we're going to do the same. I mean, and sometimes you might be with a coach, and I've spoken to some Olympic coaches, and they say, actually, sometimes works the other way. They get allocated their athlete, and they go, oh, my God, I've got that athlete for the next cycle. Jesus Christ. So how did it become enjoyable? What type of – tell me, please. I need help to understand.
Who have you been speaking to? I think the key thing for me is bringing – well, two things. The first thing is giving athletes that sense of control. So there's a really big difference. If you as a coach, you've got a training session to run with some athletes, and it's going to be a real tough mother. It's going to be awful. It's going to, you're really going to take them to their limits. There's going to be tears. It's the end of the week or whatever it is, and you know that that's the session that they've got to do. The athletes also know that they've got to do a really hard session that afternoon. But in my head, there's a really big difference between a coach going in and saying, here are two options for sessions. You choose which one you want. They're both awful, right? They're both, the worst sessions that you can possibly think of. But because you hand over the control, in you give a choice, you say, which one do you want to do? Or the last rep of the really hard set, they get to do an option of three different things. So coaches who build that into their training programs, I think that makes a huge, huge difference, because athletes feel like they retain some authority, some autonomy, and they're not just being told what to do, get on with it, train hard, work harder, do this, do that. Even though, it doesn't make any difference then physiologically which one of those they choose, they're both going to have the same effect, but it's the choice, it's giving them the choice. So that was a really key thing for me. Again, was more important for me later on in my career, and less so as a younger athlete. And then the other thing is just creativity with it. I think if you can look at a week of 60 kilometers and say, how can we get in all of the energy zones or the training zones that we need to, but make it not look like last week, then you're going to be on to a winner. We used to combine them. So we'd do some exercise in the gym, and then we'd jump in the pool and do a rep, and we'd continue that all the way through the session. That's an unusual way to train, because you're continually in and out. You're mixing weight training in a gym. Luckily, we had a poolside gym. We weren't trekking across the road to a gym in our swimming costumes. That would be, apart from the fact that it was the middle of winter. Or doing exercises on the pool side and then jumping back in the pool. just really mixing things up, getting people to do partner work in the pool. We did lots of things like, we had these really long stretchy bungee cords that you'd jump in and you'd swim as hard as you could away from, you're attached to the wall, so you'd swim as far as you could away from the wall, and it's obviously pulling you back, so it's resistance training. And then you'd spin around in the water and you'd swim as fast as you could into the wall, and it's assisting you, so it's pulling you in. But somebody on poolside has to rein in that bungee cord. And that's a, you know, it's a fun thing to do. It's hard work, it's effort for both people. But that's something that's different to just saying, right, we're just going to do some sprints this morning, which I've done 1,000 times before. So creativity, listening to athletes, maybe the other thing. I think, again, it's understanding that, athletes can have a say in their sessions. And if they're not feeling right, they know their bodies more than anybody. And again, you have to get the balance right with that, because there has to be enough trust that it's not just because they don't really feel like it this morning that they're saying, I don't want to do this session or whatever. Finding that balance where there's enough trust and respect both ways to be able to have a productive, proactive conversation about what the session holds, and both parties can come to the table with ideas.
Nice. And you would fuel my biases and Laura Mossman's biases around the number one behavior for coaches to dial up around motivation is choice. And also, I was then thinking, did you swim for bricks sometimes as well?
When I was three.
And did you wear clothes sometimes? Like, that would be good resistance, wouldn't it? So you could, like,
yeah,
everyone's dressed as Santa, they're swimming dressed as Santa.
Yeah. Well, I remember one coach once, we had a, so we can obviously do swim as in using both your arms and your legs. We can do pull, which with a pool boy in, which is only using your arms, and you can do kick with a kickboard, which is only using your legs. And we had a girl in the group who was exceptional at kick, absolutely extraordinary at kick, way, way faster than anybody else in the group. And he used to make her kick with trainers on, with a pair of old trainers on in the pool. And she, you know, she'd be so much slower, but that for her was like a resistance training. Yeah. It was pretty cool because she was doing something that other people weren't doing. I guess when you get to an elite level, what you want is to be getting out of sessions and saying, I think I did something today that nobody else in the world has done.
Yeah.
And that's not going to be a session out of a textbook. It's not going to be, 10 400s best average threshold pace or whatever it is. It's going to be something slightly different. And you have to put in those blocks of work as well. You can't have every session to be a fun and games, like mix it up and be creative. But if you can build that into the training program, I think that's when athletes keep stimulated, they stay interested, they stay curious, and they probably start having their own ideas as well.
What's the most memorable session you ever did?
Most memorable session I ever did? I guess there'd be lots that wouldn't probably translate that well to a podcast unless you're a massive swimming geek, which I expect you're not. There was a fairly memorable one back in, I must have been 11 or 12, and I went on a first kind of international camp with other girls kind of my age, so early teen years really. Yeah. And the coach there, bearing in mind most of our training is made up of kind of 100s, 200s, sometimes 400 meter reps. That's the kind of standard for my discipline. And he made us do a 2000 meter straight, so without stopping, best average, so best pace that you possibly could. And it was on your number one stroke. So for me as a backstroker, that's hard but not impossible. But for the breaststrokers, which is a really slow stroke,
butterfly. And
for the butterfly swimmers. So it is memorable for the wrong reasons, in the fact that I felt so lucky to be a backstroke swimmer then, looking across at the other girls in the butterfly lane, who, the furthest you race butterfly is 200 meters. So it's 10 race distances, basically. And it was all to do with it wasn't really probably a training, a legitimate training session. It was more to do with just being tough, just hearing a session and saying, yeah, I'm just going to get on with that the best way that I can, and instead of moaning about it or complaining about it. So that was probably a rude awakening for those girls, definitely, and it solidified my decision to be a backstroker.
Yeah, I would be swimming past them like that. Sorry, everyone. Just
holding on to their feet underneath the lane rope.
And what's the so you're obviously doing a variety of things now. You're doing a bit of coaching. You're doing some businessy type stuff. Let's talk about the coaching. If I came and watched you coach my daughter, what three or four words or phrases do you hope I would use to describe your coaching?
Well, that's a difficult question. I'd hope it'd be fun. I think for young athletes, so for me, I don't coach elite athletes. I coach when I go in and do masterclasses. It's kind of 8 to 15-year-olds usually, and I think for most young athletes, the most important thing is that they're enjoying themselves. And I think the other focus would be on kind of putting aside or managing to put aside the way that you've always done it to be able to try new things. Because I think when you've done a skill for a long time, whether you've been doing it right or you've been doing it wrong, it can be really difficult to change that, especially if you can't see yourself doing it. And it's, you know, it's the reason why as elite athletes we get filmed all the time, because it's much easier to see yourself doing a skill incorrectly than for a coach just to say, oh, your arm's going into the water slightly wrong or your hip's not rotating enough. It's much easier if you can visualize it. So for young athletes particularly, it can be really difficult to see that. I wouldn't be making them work hard. I always think that skills come before hard work, and actually that goes against probably my history, saying that I started doing 60k a week when I was 13. But at any point in a young athlete's career, you can give them 6 months of tough training and you'll take their fitness from a 3 out of 10 to an 8 out of 10. But if they ingrain poor skills and poor habits at an early age, you can't change them, or you very rarely can change them later down the line. So you see a lot of athletes, particularly in swimming, because there is a bit of a mentality of do more, do more, do more. But you see a lot of young swimmers get to a point where, you know, they're really successful as teenagers, and then they get to a point where their skills are holding them back, and they can't change them because they've practiced those poor skills and the meters and the hard work came above and beyond the skills. So if I was going in to work with a club or I was going in to run a masterclass, I would try and help them understand the importance of that skill level, because you can build on the fitness at any point.
Do you think the, and I would want you to coach my daughter, do you think the distance is the quantity over quality is changing? People's mindset around that?
I think it's starting to change. I think like any change, it's a slow process. I think it can be difficult because lots of coaches in the UK have been swimmers themselves. And if they've been swimmers themselves, they'll have definitely been through the regime of, you know, tough training, more meters, taking the tally at the end of the week. And, you know, that's the most important thing, is that you're super fit. And I think the real challenge is that having really fit athletes doing a lot of hard work at an early age, it does produce, to a limited extent, results. So bearing in mind that these age group coaches don't retain the athletes, they won't keep them past 16, 17, 18, because they'll go on to a university program or they'll go into a national center. So in terms of immediate results, the best thing that an age group coach can do to get them onto, you know, get their name on the map or prove that, you know, they're a really good coach, is to try and get medals at county levels, at district levels, and at national level. And the way that you do that is probably not saying, okay, well, actually, I'm looking at this with a really long-term view, and I want you to have the best skills you can possibly have, and that comes before, you know, getting you absolutely really fit for the national championships this summer. So it's always a balance. It's always going to be a balance. There are coaches who are doing both really well, and then there are probably some coaches who have got the balance slightly wrong in either way. Some that aren't. But I guess it's the best coaches are probably the ones that see an athlete as having a longer career beyond their time in the club program, and they can see that with a long-term view. But I understand that that's difficult to do.
Yeah, similar in team sports. So very similar in rugby, football, easy, quickest results, give some people some high training ages as quickly as possible. Possibly pick the people that are, I mean, obviously it's team stuff as well, but in the relay, probably leave out the people that aren't quite so good now and maybe in the future. Are there some people who came into swimming late? Does that exist?
Yeah, definitely. Well, to name an incredibly famous example, Adam Peaty, I think at the age of 11 or 12, was ranked kind of 200th in the district. So like, you know, you would have looked at me as an athlete at that age and said, oh, absolutely, she's got a future ahead of her. And you would have looked at him at that age and probably thought, oh, he maybe should try a different sport. And absolutely, and I think it's maybe one of the reasons he's so successful now is that he's not even near, I don't think, to getting to that burnout stage of having, you know, those thousands and thousands of lengths behind him, because that takes a toll. It's toll at some point. So I think, yeah, I think it's worked in his favour. Again, the thing that he does very well is he's an incredibly skillful athlete. So he did, you know, start to build really, really good technique. I remember hearing a great story about a young breaststroker who raced against Adam in the early days before he became, you know, anywhere near making a team or anywhere near a household name. And he raced against him, and this other guy didn't swim particularly well. And he got out of the pool and he said to his coach, "That's embarrassing. I just got beaten by Adam Peaty." You know, nobody in the world would say that now. You know, you expect to get beaten by Adam Peaty. So, yeah, definitely. Adam and his coach Mel have got an incredibly special bond, special relationship, and they've done some incredible work across the years. But they probably do break the mold a little bit, because he wasn't at the younger ages, those mid-teenagers, necessarily one who you'd fast track onto programs and things like that.
And what stuff have you learned from swimming that you think's relevant to other people, to businesses, to organizations? To what's the little tips and nuggets that you're taking out to the world?
How long have you got? I think one of the most important things for me is around kind of identity and who you are. I think lots of people, when they're trying to change their behavior, they focus on outcomes. They say, I want to achieve X, Y, Z. I want, you know, this result, and I want a KPI. I want to lose weight. I want to be able to run a marathon, whatever it is. And they very quickly kind of give up on that stuff if you don't see proof of progress that you're on track for that. And I think I often got asked whether athletes were kind of just superhumans when it came to motivation and stuff like that. You know, how do you get through those really tough blocks of training week after week, month after month, and year after year, keep going back into it? And when I was competing, I kind of thought, maybe we are just superhuman. Maybe we do just have a slightly different, you know, amount of motivation to normal people who sometimes can't get out of bed in the morning. But since stopping, I've realized that isn't true. I'm the same as everybody else. When it comes to motivation, and I go up and down depending on, you know, what I'm doing. But the thing that I think keeps athletes going is that they have an incredibly strong identity. This is just what I do. This is who I am. And I think it's much more powerful for people to say, this is the kind of person I want to be. This is how I want to be perceived by my family, my friends, my team at work, rather than just, this is the result that I want. And I think I talk about, you know, sport is outcome focused. It is KPIs. It is, you know, rankings and statistics and stuff like that. But I talk about how when I was 9, I watched the Sydney Olympics on TV. And I was so inspired by watching them that I decided I wanted to one day go to a Games. I wanted to compete at an Olympic Games for my country. And that's a pretty big outcome focused goal for a 9-year-old. But I also decided there and then that I wanted to be an Olympian. So I made an identity shift at that point as well. I decided I want to be an elite athlete. This is what I want. And it was that decision, I think, that started to shape my behavior over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, probably 6 years till I realistically thought I could go to a Games, and 8 years. But I just started saying to myself, what would an Olympian do here? what would an Olympian do in this situation? And those choices then around things like going out and partying versus not nine, but, you know, mid-teens and things, eating the mini eggs or eating the healthy food, exactly. It just became quite an easy choice in my head because I started to say, what would an Olympian do? What would an elite athlete do? And I think it's a really interesting concept for people to identify the identity of the person who realizes their dream. So whatever the dream is, have it for vision, have it for direction. But whoever's achieving that now, what's the identity that they adopt? What's the behaviors that they have each day rather than just the stuff that they do? And I think that's a really interesting area that probably sport gets right, but not really, it's not really a conscious thing. This wasn't something that I processed when I was competing. But maybe other people don't quite get right, and it's why people can't stick to new behaviours and new behavioural change. So,
what do you think? And just so people know, I was holding up my mini eggs and Coke. I would be a food Olympian at the moment. What do you think? There's unintended consequences to that?
Yeah, definitely. Around identity, and I think, you know, as I said, part of what sustains an athlete for so long is this all-encompassing identity of I'm an athlete, I'm an Olympian, this is who I am. And I guess the unintended consequence or the negative consequences of that is that it can be really, really difficult for athletes to step away from sport because this is who I am. And then suddenly I wake up one morning having announced my official retirement, and that's been stripped from me completely. And identity loss is a huge, huge challenge for athletes that are coming out into the real world, as I call it. But there's a lot of work being done with athletes at the moment to help them understand that absolutely that is their priority identity. That is what, you know, is shaping their behavior on a day-to-day basis. But that actually there is far more to them than just their scoreboard results, than just their rankings, because that can be if you're getting all your confidence from that can be a difficult thing as well.
Yeah, I was speaking to an Olympic coach, and he said he was really finding it hard actually to coach people that didn't have almost that dual identity of something else alongside it. So whether it's I do this and I do this, you know, work.
Yeah, definitely.
Or whatever.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a stigma around it, because I think athletes and coaches think that if I've not put 100% into my sport, if I've not spent all of my time thinking, sleeping, breathing, eating, swimming, then how can I possibly stand up on the blocks at the Olympic Games and know that I've done everything in my power to achieve the best result that I can? But there have been lots of studies done to say that actually that isn't the healthiest mindset. And that athletes who are a bit more balanced, who have other focuses, retain better perspective around their sporting career and are happier, but also perform better at the end of the day because they have that better balance, because they know that, you know, yes, their sport is important to them, but it isn't the be-all and end-all. It's not going to be the end of their life. And they're able to go into major competitions with much less anxiety than the person who says, this is all that I am, this is all that I've got. And actually the consequences of me not performing are catastrophic.
Yeah, you do a full start and that's all.
Well, exactly. And to go into a competition with that anxiety of this will be a deconstruction of who I am if it goes wrong is terrifying. You know, that's not that's not a conscious thought that athletes are having when they go in. But if you build it up over your career to be defined by your results from sport, then the anxiety and stress involved in going to a competition, knowing that you're defined by your successes and failures in whatever competition you're doing, is really scary. It's really nerve-wracking and can cause a lot of undue nerves, worries, and anxieties. It's a super important area to help athletes. And I think it starts young. I think it starts during those, you know, teenage years when they're trying to start choosing between their sport and their education. And I think you can absolutely do both.
Nice. Well, what other stuff? What other areas you've been exploring with people?
Have a think. Another one would be around do to certain situations. And I also
You just dropped out. You was, another one would be what?
Helping people understand stress and understand why they react the way that they do to high pressure situations and how they can hopefully manage them better. Because again, our brains can't differentiate between different types of stress. The stress that I feel walking out to, you know, a competition, a final in the competition, is no different to somebody walking into an interview or to a promotion panel or something like that. So you take the context out of the way, and actually the physiological response is absolutely identical. So hopefully help people understand a bit more about why they feel like that. And most importantly, obviously, help them develop strategies to be able to manage that in a better way.
How did you do another, how did that fit into your career? What type of things were, when were you stressed? Was it competition? Was it injury? What was it?
Yeah, definitely competitions, high stakes competitions. I think, so we learned chimp management as a psychological model. So it was kind of an easy way of understanding the way that our brain processes logic, but also emotion as well. And why, for a very, you know, advanced species, it's quite funny that we can't really differentiate between something that's trivially stressful in terms of going out and doing a swimming race versus seeing some actual danger, seeing some actual threat in the jungle or whatever it was. Our brain responds in exactly the same way. So understanding the reason it does that, and then also creating strategies around how to get back into that more logical, rational mode, which you need to be able to compete successfully. You can't be in emotional mode, because if you're in emotional mode, you're going to see, for example, somebody else that's going past you in a race, and you're going to respond emotionally to that and think, oh crap, I've got to, you know, go faster, catch up with them, overtake them, and that could be the end of your race. Whereas if you're in processing mode, if you're in logical, rational mode, then you think, I'm going to execute the race to my best ability, to my race plan, and I'm going to stick to that regardless of what the people are doing around me. And that's going to give me the best possible chance of success. So it was all about understanding how to flip back into that human rational mode and not stay in that emotional state, because lots of people don't even know that they've gone into that emotional state. They react suboptimally to something happening. And then afterwards, they kind of think, why did I respond like that? You know, it wasn't that much of a big deal that somebody called me out in a meeting, or that this didn't go exactly the way that I wanted it to. But in the moment, they don't have the skills and the strategies in place to be able to rationalize what they're hearing or what's going on around them. So a bit of a psychological lesson, I guess. I use lots of references from chimp management, which I found immensely helpful.
Did you have a name during my career? Did you have a name for your chimp?
I just call it Chimpy. But it's now become, you know, part of my vocabulary. Is when I'm feeling stressed, when I'm feeling anxious, if I'm feeling upset about something, I will then go and tell somebody that I am chimpy. Like I say, I'm feeling a bit chimpy at the moment. Can we have a discussion about this? So obviously that works for people who know what I'm talking about, but others, they're like, what's this lunatic on about? So so that's a key one. And then I think the next one that people, it really resonates with people, would be about kind of failure and developing resilience. And you know, navigating setback and navigating failure and things like that. So that would be another key area that I tend to go into a lot of detail with, because I, like many athletes, had lots of successes, but just as many failures in my career. And it was probably the failures that were the defining moments for me.
Yeah, what were your tactics around that? What worked for you, and what's your kind of, what principles are you sharing with people around it?
Yeah, so I talk a lot about London. So I went to Beijing when I was 17, and it was, you know, it was really exciting, really far away from home. I was a very young athlete, and there wasn't much pressure on me. I did really well there. I came sixth in when I competed there, and then I qualified for London 4 years later. And I wasn't ranked to get a medal. I wasn't expected to get a medal, but I absolutely went there with the intention of getting a medal. So when I kind of saw fourth place next to my name, my first kind of thought was that I let myself down with that. And you know, fourth place is kind of the worst place for an athlete to finish. in a race, excruciatingly close. Significant disappointment or adversity within my career. But I realized that if I was ever going to reframe London, which I felt quite negative about, then I was going to have to change my perception on success and failure. So the two, I guess, key lessons for me that came out of that was, the first one was about choice, that I was making the choice after London to focus on the negative, to obsess about what I'd missed out on, what I'd not come home with, instead of choosing to focus on the incredible achievement that I'd been. And, you know, nobody else was telling me that I'd failed. Nobody else was telling me that I'd let myself down. I'd let them down. I'd let the country down. Yet I was choosing to obsess about that. And I had to take responsibility for that choice that I was making. And that was a really big shift in mindset for me, because I realized that we all have ownership over our interpretation of events. And I think this is a massively important lesson that goes, you know, transcends sport, goes far beyond sport, because everybody has challenges, everybody has barriers, everybody has things that happen to them that they wish weren't happening, and some of them are trivial and some of them are major, but we also all have a choice in the way that we perceive them, and we can squirm, we can sulk, we can complain, we can make excuses, we can blame other people, or we can accept that whatever's happening is happening, and use it as an opportunity to grow, to develop, to pivot, to become more knowledgeable. So that was the first lesson for me, was all about choice. And this is something that I try and dig into other parts of my life. And it applied to other parts of sport as well. There was a big difference between the athletes who get injured and say, well, that's it. That's the end of my season. That's, you know, the end of, I might as well just give up now because I can't use my ankle for 2 weeks, versus the athlete that says, well, that's not ideal. I can't use my ankle for 2 weeks, but I'm going to see how strong my upper body can get in that time. I'm going to prioritize my core strength, which I know has been a weakness in the past, and see if I can actually surpass where I was in terms of skills before that. And it's a complete, two athletes, exactly the same boat, but two completely separate mindsets. One of them, their season's ruined, and one of them actually probably ends up stronger than they were before because they developed skills, they pivoted in a different direction, and they were able to change their perception to benefit them. So that's obviously kind of the lesson about choice. And then the other one for me was all about confidence, because it took a really big hit to my confidence when I didn't get that medal. And it goes back to what we were saying before about, you know, being defined by your successes and failures in sport. And I think that I'd been relying on that medal to feel confident about myself, to you know, feel worthy as a person. And I realized that I'd actually done that my whole career. I'd use my sporting results to generate confidence. So my identity as an athlete and my personal identity were completely mixed up. They were as one, which meant that I was defined by those successes and failures in the pool. So instead of that scoreboard being a display of how quickly I could spin my arms backwards, which is the reality of swimming, it was a judgment of character. And I didn't have the skills to generate my own confidence, so I used the kind of scoreboard to do it for me. And I think lots of people can relate to that, because in other industries, because often we rely on affirmation from other people that we are funny enough, that we are clever enough, that we are good looking enough, that we are successful enough. And actually we struggle to just have acceptance and trust that we are enough without that. So it was an interesting lesson for me to learn. And actually this happened that, you know, that London was a long time ago now, and I've only just fully stopped, or think I've stopped kind of processing this, and only recently kind of realized that, although at the time it seemed like the very worst thing that possibly happened to me to come fourth and just miss out on a medal, it taught me to value myself above and beyond my sporting results. And it taught me, I guess, kind of acceptance away from the affirmation of other people. And that was something that, you know, is an invaluable lesson to learn. And I was going to have to learn it at some point, having, you know, used my sport to, I guess, gain confidence for so long. I was going to have a fall at some point to learn that lesson. But it was a difficult one to learn on and the biggest stage in the world. But it's definitely something, looking back now, that I think has helped me more resilient and in my career as well. That's a story I often tell to people, because I think there's a failure is such a negatively charged word for us, but in our society nobody wants to fail, nobody wants to be a failure, and yet resilience is revered. It's a desirable skill, but in my opinion you can't really develop resilience unless you experience some kind of failure. So it's ironic that we fear failure and yet we desire the result that it produces. And I think people can relate to that. And I think, you know, if I was workshopping with people in a business or something, we'd start looking at risk and what's, you know, acceptable risk versus catastrophic risk, and how you can kind of get those mini failures so that you start to become more resilient and start to place less worth on my results define me in any industry.
Yeah, we came fourth in Delhi. I'm still getting over it. I'm joking.
Maybe you need to come to one of my workshops. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And have you found the transition? So when did you stop swimming? How long ago?
A year and a half ago. Almost 2 years ago now.
Same as me getting made redundant. So I was a couple of months after you. So tell me, how you found it? What's been the opportunities? What's been the stuff that you've found hard? It's obviously something that's, you know, it's all over the place, really. Lots of people struggling around, people from, yeah, transitioning often as from an athlete to a, you know, to the real world.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, I guess some really good things about transitioning, and then some difficult things as well, as I inevitably knew there would be. The kind of pros would obviously be having more time, more energy, less structure to my year to be able to pursue other things. And that was one of the main reasons why I stepped away from sport, was because I felt like I had more to give in other areas and I didn't have the time or the energy or the freedom to be able to do that whilst I was still competing. So it's been really nice for me to be able to experiment at other things, to try skills that I'd not been honing for the last 15 years. And actually just, you know, even though sport is difficult and it's tough and you're pushing yourself and you are in many senses outside of your comfort zone physically, you're not really outside of your comfort zone, because I was so comfortable in the pool. You know, that was my environment. That was the place that I knew like the back of my hand. It was so easy to go there. So it's been nice to actually step outside of my comfort zone and do things that, hey, I'm not good at, and see improvement with those as well. Because that's the other thing, when you're competing at that level, any improvements is so incremental. They're so tiny. So it's really cool to try other skills and actually see much quicker improvement. And you get a bit of a buzz for that. I struggle with the identity thing, you know, hanging up the goggles and no longer being an elite athlete, no longer being part of that special club that you are. If you, you know, if you're an Olympian, you're part of a very small set of people. And there's something really cool and really special about being in that club. And then I felt like I'd kind of been kicked out of the club and I wasn't part of it anymore. But for me, it was the change. And I did struggle for a few months. I did have a few rough months at the end of 2018 where I just didn't really feel motivated. I didn't have direction. I didn't know what I was doing. And I wasn't particularly fussed about going after anything. And I didn't recognize that lack of drive in myself. Because I've been so familiar with those high levels of motivation that I've had throughout my career. But the turning point, I guess, was going back to that mindset of choice. And I, you know, again, I was choosing to see the transition as, oh, these are all the things that I'm missing out on from sport. I'm not traveling the world with my mates anymore. I'm not competing at the highest level. I'm no longer, you know, on social media and people going, oh, how's your training going? What's going on? Reporting back from a competition. I'm not doing that anymore. And that's what I was choosing to focus on, rather than choosing to say, hey, like, that chapter was awesome and I'm so privileged to have done the things that I've done and competed at those levels, but actually now look at the opportunities that I have ahead of me, because I've got freedom, I've got autonomy, I've got choice, I can do whatever I want to do. I can, you know, try and go after any job that I want. I can write, I can be creative, I can talk to people, I can pass on my knowledge, I can find, you know, 100 other things that I'm passionate about. And actually, that's really exciting. Getting away from choosing to focus on what I was missing and actually starting to reframe that into, hey, but look what I've got ahead of me, because that's super exciting. So at the moment, I feel good about stuff. I'm still probably don't have a huge amount of clarity about where I'll be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time.
And I imagine I'll maybe...
Yeah, well, it is. And again, that was at the beginning, that was quite unnerving, because I was so familiar with having a schedule for the year. These are your training blocks. These are what you're going to be doing. This is when the competition is. This is when your time off is going to be. This is your nutritional plan along the way. Go and get on with it, kind of thing. And actually, I suddenly didn't have any of that structure. And it was really unnerving to not know what I was doing in 6 months' time or a year's time. But actually now I quite like it. No 2 weeks are the same for me anymore. You know, I'm doing different things pretty much every single day. And that's really cool. I have full autonomy over my diary, which again is really cool after having a coach say this is the schedule. And I'm really enjoying it. I think I probably will continue, at least for the time being, enjoying a bit of a portfolio career, trying my hand at a few different things, as I said before, some in sport still and some outside of sport. Just enjoying kind of seeing where it takes me, I guess. Using the opportunities that are coming along.
Do you still swim?
Everybody asks this question.
I have this image of you forgetting that you're now self-employed and standing outside the swimming baths in let's say Keynsham, at 5:30 going, wasn't it?
Where is everyone?
Rusty,
there's absolutely no chance of that happening. be assured that I will not accidentally be setting my alarm for 4 a.m.
So my question is, do you still swim? And if you do, do you go in the fast lane?
I do still swim, but not anywhere near as much as I used to. So I go once or twice a week, and I go and do about half an hour, 45 minutes, compared to, we'd usually do 2 hours, 2.5 hours, so a lot less than I'm familiar with. But I mainly actually go for a bit of headspace, because it's a bit of a timeout. It's away from distraction, it's away from noise, it's away from technology. And I didn't realize that I needed that until I stopped swimming and realized that actually I probably had 4 or 5 hours of it most days, because the majority of training is following that black line up and down the bottom of the pool. And you know, that was my headspace. That was my time out where I got a bit of mental space and could process emotions and thoughts and start planning and ideas and stuff like that. So I go to the pool. I don't train. I still find it difficult to think about going and doing a hard session, whereas I'm more than happy to go and destroy myself out on a bike for a couple of hours. But it's odd to go to the pool without a coach there, without a team there, and think about actually training. I hope in the future I will maybe re-engage with it a bit more. But for the moment, I'm still massively in that space where the novelty is not having to go to the pool every single day. So maybe it'll stay my quiet zone. I do go in the fast lane.
Of course you do. We just come back from skiing, and skiing is my equivalent of your swimming.
Yeah.
It's my
Well, after 15 years of water-based sport, I think skiing might be a bit of a slow burner for me, because my knees are basically on backwards by this point. So, I'd love to go skiing at some point in the future, but it's definitely one that I'd have to be a little bit cautious about my joints.
Yeah. I've got a few one-worders for you to finish. One-word answers, please, if you can. Swimming.
I guess calm. Calm.
Oh, I thought you were going to go with the devil. Adam Peaty.
Superhuman.
Transition.
Opportunity.
Olympics.
everything.
London 2012.
Memories.
Coaching.
Balance.
Nice. That was, I felt very balanced.
They were tough. They were tough.
It was good. I was, yeah, look, it's been awesome listening to you. I've got loads from it. I hope lots of other coaches have as well. Where can people find you? What's the crack? If you're not down the swimming pool, where are you?
Where can people find me? Well, if I'm not down at the swimming pool, I'm all over the place. I travel all across the country. I'm based in Bristol, work a lot in London. In terms of social media and things like that, people can find me on Twitter. I'm Lizzie Simmons 1, as in the number 1. And they can also email me at info@lizziesimmons.com, because I'm always happy to chat to people, always happy to discuss opportunities and ideas. I love hearing people's perspectives, and yeah, get in touch.
Awesome. Who put us in touch with each other? Who connected us?
So a PE teacher at head of PE, I think, at my old school, who I wasn't teach by. Are we doing a shout out to Tom?
To Tom, I completely forgot. At Lincoln Minster School, so you're originally Lincoln, correct?
Yeah. So my parents live in Lincoln. I went to Lincoln Minster School, who were absolutely brilliant with me as an athlete and student at the same time, and trying to balance both of those things. And I think Tom moved there a few years after I left. And I went back there recently and did a talk to their sports scholars, and he put me in touch with you after that.
There we go. Beautiful. I knew that was a good idea. Lizzie, thanks so much. I'm really excited to stay in touch and see what 2020 holds for you. I love the fact that you spent Christmas iterating the stuff you've already done, and it's going to be even better. Thanks a lot, and have a great day.
Thank you, Angie.